Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Latin America Review. This is our live show that we do every week. It's free for all. And we upload it to the RSS stream so you can listen on any podcast apps as well. We also have, of course, a weekly podcast for Patreon subscribers. So make sure to sign up there as well. And today we're going to be talking about Peru, about the coup in Peru, about the resistance to the coup in Peru. I was just there myself. I've literally just got back right now. I'm in La Paz now, Bolivia. I was just over the border in the town of Desaguadero in Peru. So I got to see firsthand some of the protests that were going on. But we're here today with some special guests. We've got Claudia O'Brien Moscoso, who is from the Black Alliance for Peace and the Haiti Americas team. She's Peruvian. She's there in Peru right now in Lima, if I'm not mistaken. We also got Zoe Alexander, co-editor of People's Dispatch, and she was also in Peru reporting on what was going on. So she's going to add them in.
Hello,
Zoe. Hello, Claudia. Claudia, I understand you're in Lima right now.
Hi. Yes, I'm in Lima right now. I was hoping to be at Plaza San Miguel because right now it's been about a half hour ago. A large mobilization started in Lima at San Miguel, Plaza San Miguel. But I wasn't sure that I'd find reliable Wi-Fi.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we could hear you well. The image is a little bit frozen, but Zoe, how's it going? You were in Peru reporting after the coup took place, and obviously in Peru we've seen an intensification of the repression from the government against those opposed to the coup regime. Just to start off, can you tell us a little bit about what you saw when you were in Peru? Were you in Lima, I think? And, what was the sense from protesters? Because from what I saw this past couple of days in Peru is that people are ready to strap in for the long haul and they're not going to be backing down anytime soon. But how was it at the time of the coup when you were there?
Definitely. I was there, I think, a week and a half after the coup took place. And you definitely got the sense that people are really, really fed up with the narrative that's being put forth by the media, the narrative that's being put forth by politicians, the way that they've responded to the protests, not only with the horrific and violent repression, but the way that the demands of the protesters are being characterized, the way the government is really refusing to engage with anything they're actually proposing. And I think this has only given more fuel to their fire, kind of given more justification behind all of their demands. I'm sure you saw it as well, but the demand for a constituent assembly and really underlying that, the demand that the entire system just be turned on its head is so powerful because people are so angry with the way the racist colonialist system in the country where the center of power in Lima just has so much control over the distribution of resources, over the concessions that are given to foreign mining companies. And people are crystal clear about that. They know exactly what they're up against. And they know that the only way is to continue in struggle and really continue these strong demands. So I was really, just 1 week and a half, it had been 2 days after some of the massacres took place on December 15th. People were infuriated about these actions, also upset with the fact that in Lima, there were protests, but they were smaller scale. There was also the raid on the Peasant Federation headquarters when I was there. So increasing levels of repression, criminalization, I think all of those trends continue today.
Yeah, absolutely. We lost Claudia for a moment. We'll bring her back. But I think it's important to go over some of what actually happened during the coup itself. And at the time, I remember, especially in foreign media, there was almost universal narrative that the removing of the ousting of Pedro Castillo was something that was entirely justified because he called new elections and suspended Congress. But now we can see that he was suspending Congress and calling new elections precisely to avoid exactly what's happening now, because that was due to be debated in the Congress was a motion to impeach him and to install Dina Boluarte as president. So the same timeline of events would be happening, even if Pedro Castillo hadn't made that announcement, because the impeachment was actually incoming. Claudia, let's see if we can try again and see how your connection is. You're there in Lima. What is the mood like in Lima? Because Lima is a complicated terrain, especially for social movements, because on the one hand, that is where the middle class base for the right-wing parties in Peru and for this current regime is. But on the other hand, you know, Lima is an enormous city, like 10 million people. Like that's actually the size of Bolivia, the whole country of Bolivia. And so especially around the working class areas, you have huge, you know, townships where people were more sympathetic to President Pedro Castillo. So how's it been in Lima, where you have, you know, both sides really represented in the way that, like, for example, when I was in Desaguadero, everyone in the community is on one side, so to speak, and that is in opposition. But in Lima, is there a certain tension every day?
Yeah. Well, so you definitely feel the class tensions here. It's very precise. So where I grew up is in Barrios Altos, near the centro of Lima. Where I live now is a upper middle class neighborhood, Lince. Working class area still, but definitely upper middle class. And you definitely see the divide. So when the repression first started, here in Lima, there was actually celebrations that he had been ousted. And that's really what you see here. So if I'm walking around where I live now, there's no coup, everything is fine. The, you know, savage Indians, as they say, you know, are just having their brainwashed by Evo. In Bolivia, they have no agency. They couldn't possibly be upset that they are being massacred and gunned down from helicopters, from what even the doctor in Puno and Juliaca was talking about how the projectiles were entering the body and exploding inside. Something that caught my attention, thinking how a lot of Palestinian doctors have said similar things in regards to what the IDF uses. So, and we know a lot of this is very much the machinations, US machinations in the background, right? Southcom General Commander Cora Richardson, not too long ago, I forget exactly how many years ago, had been talking about the rich resources we have in this area, and particularly lithium, right? 60% of the world's lithium is in this region. And it's certainly no accident that, you know, 2019 Bolivia, the number one lithium producer of the world, fell to a CIA coup. And now the number two lithium producer in the world has fallen to a CIA coup. So yeah, Lima is, there's a lot of class tension here. If you go, like I said, if you go to like more of the working class areas in like North Peru, North Lima, some of the Torres, Rimac, those areas are definitely as much as possible, you know, engaging and out, and if they can, involved in a general strike. But it's certainly not what needs to be. Although yesterday I was walking around this area and I did see or hear some protests coming down, Dos de Mayo, which is very, you know, especially this area is like by San Isidro, is very much the wealthy upper class neighborhood.
Yeah, definitely. And interesting. So you're from Barrios Altos. That was actually where a massacre took place during the Fujimori regime, one of the most infamous massacres, I think, in the early parts of his regime. 91. Yeah, that's it. The massacre of Barrios Altos. Zoe, I mean, if we... Were you surprised to see the level of organization, of anger in Peru, because I think the when the coup took place, and I think the people doing the coup, I think we're banking on the fact that banking on the idea that Pedro Castillo was very unpopular. Obviously, there's, you know, a lot of election promises, for example, from the campaign that Pedro Castillo didn't implement, and they thought no one's going to come out onto the streets. So, yeah, I mean, was that something that surprised you? And were people talking about Pedro Castillo there, or was this about something larger as well?
Well, I think it's both things, because in Pedro Castillo, it's from speaking to people and just the way that they're referring to the treatment that he received by the Peruvian oligarchy, it's in many ways kind of a representation of how they're treated. Many are saying, well, if he can be just taken out by a coup, if he can be defamed in the media, that's exactly what happens to us on a daily basis. And I think this is true, that there's a very, very strong base of support behind him. You know, he won in what many people said a surprise election. But of course, for so many Peruvians, this wasn't a surprise. The fact that there could be a candidate who can speak for the indigenous and rural population, for someone who's not from the elites, who's not having a background of just using the state coffer as its, you know, personal bank account and making corrupt deals with multinational companies, someone whose slogan of no more poor people in a rich country, this really speaks to people. And I think they were cognizant of all of the different challenges that he was faced with. I mean, they're the ones who are seeing exactly how the media is portraying him. They're the ones who are seeing exactly how he's being attacked every single day of his presidency, seeing that the legislative body, which they are already against, it has a, I think, 10% approval rating at the end in December. They know what the Congress is doing to stop every single one of his proposals, to stop his cabinets from being approved. And they're extremely clear about that. So I think, you know, of course, the elites, once again, underestimating people's consciousness, underestimating what centuries of oppression does, and that people actually know what they want, why they're being mistreated, and that this person, Pedro Castillo, is kind of a representation of all of this. And that was something that was extremely prevalent, is that speaking to victims of people who had suffered, who had been attacked in these mobilizations, who's had lost family members, and they're still saying, and we will continue fighting and demand that Pedro Castillo be released because he is one of us. This treatment that he's receiving is unfair, and that, you know, we need justice. This government, the way this government treats its people is not justice, and it's never going to give justice to the Peruvian people. And that the way that the state is structured, the way the constitution is written, that's never going to be a system that serves the people. And many pointed out, for example, the number of concessions on natural resources, both oil, gas, and precious minerals that are coming up, and that a coup government like this one will definitely take advantage of. And so those are things that are very present on people's minds. And I think that's something that's so important to always remember, is that the people actually really have a very strong level of consciousness. And that's something that the elites will never understand, of how you can make such sacrifices every day and be on the streets, risk your lives. They will never understand that motivation of a people who are determined to win their liberation.
Yeah, that was at the protest I was at in Desaguadero just now. People were mentioning the fact that the concessions and state contracts for the exploiting natural resources are coming up. And that's why they want elections now, so that people actually have a say over these things. Because if there's not elections till 2024, all those contracts will be done and all the resources will be in the hands of, you know, the foreign corporations. And you won't be able to do anything without, you know, even if you do try and nationalize, the cost of that will be enormous, because there's, you know, that is already in the hands of the transnational corporations. Claudia, I'm not sure how. Claudia. So, how does the media and people, especially middle class people in Lima, talk about the sorts of people that are protesting, particularly in the south of Peru, indigenous regions of Peru? I remember when I used to live in Lima, people would feel quite comfortable saying, thing, you know, things about indigenous people that would get you in a lot of trouble here in Bolivia. People would be too scared to say here in Bolivia, even people of the right-wing opposition. But what are some of the terms that they use, both politicians and the media, about those that are protesting?
Yeah, well, so the Limeña press here is, I believe, the number one and number two, Comercio, and I forget the other one, are actually owned by families that have a stake in these contracts, are owners. And so sometimes they just happen to be also the owners of those industries that would get those contracts, but not necessarily, right? The press here is absolutely, they don't care. They talk about the folks that are dying as, terrucos, bringing up the, infamous past of terrorism and justifying, once again, using the Fujimorista logic of, we're gonna need to gun everyone down because they're all terrorists, they're all savages, Indians. They don't know what they're talking about. Even here, going to the mercado, you could hear people just saying like, "Oh, you don't know what you're talking." When rightfully, by 17 deaths in one day, you don't know what you're talking about. They are, terrorists. So the press here is absolutely, one in the same with these Libero Fachos. The longer same thing. The streets here, that all these organs of power don't actually serve us. This repression is happening. They're ramming through,
So I'm just gonna.
They're ramming through like about 40 different mining laws. Sorry.
Oh no, thanks, Claudia. You're just cutting up quite a lot. I was just gonna give a pause. But yeah, we've got a question in the chat. Make sure if you've got questions for any of either Cloudy or Zoe or myself, put them in the chat. We'll read them out. We've got one from Leah Bog saying, "What other responses from other countries in the global south have leaders come spoken out against the coup and supporting the people?" And yeah, this is something that one of the protesters I was speaking to yesterday was saying he wants the presidents of Latin America to speak out, that he even named López Obrador and Luis Arce from Bolivia and Pedro from Colombia, etc. But Zoe, I think we see, if we look at the context in Latin America, I always think that if this had happened, this coup in Peru had happened in 2018 or 2019, they would be in a much stronger position than they are now. And actually now they look quite isolated within the region. You do have now, especially in South America, a majority of progressive governments who have taken a dim view about what's going on. Can we say that the Peru is more isolated now than it would have been, say, a few years ago if this could happen then?
I think that's definitely right, and it's been very powerful to see the response of the region. I think Andrés Manuel López Obrador, of course, has been such an important voice in so many of these instances in the past couple of years. Of course, in the coup against Evo Morales, he played such a central role in facilitating, of course, the safe passage of Evo. Similarly, with the family of Pedro Castillo, and the response of the regime of Dina Boluarte, it's clear that it's threatened by its neighbors. It exiles the Mexican ambassador, bans the entry of Evo Morales. Clearly, they don't really see them as their neighbors or friends. And I think they are isolated, but that's not to say that they're in a great, either way, I think they're feeling the pressure. And I think this is a definitely positive step. But at the end of the day, it's still extremely unfortunate that as long as they have the stamp of approval from the United States and the U.S. Embassy, they're still not changing their tune. Because even after a visit from the IACHR, they carried out this horrific massacre. It's a level of impunity that's just difficult to understand, that they're completely ignoring what their neighbors are saying. They're completely ignoring what the people are on the streets are saying. The U.S. yesterday, through the State Department, released a statement saying that there should be some dialogue, that perhaps this violence was not the best response. Still, there's not a strong condemnation. I think, Ali, you've made this point several times. If this were, I just can't even imagine the response it would have if this happened in Venezuela or this happened in Cuba. Of course, it wouldn't happen because of the different political context. But that being said, I mean, the response of the U.S. to this, to what's been happening, has just been extremely appalling. Supporting Dina Boluarte completely, giving her, of course, the stamp of approval. And so even though there has been pressure from these regional governments, and that is a huge advancement. And I think Gustavo Petro has even has really actually marked the tone in a lot of ways. But it's still so unfortunate that even with all of this, this government just is not backing down.
Yeah. We've got a question. Petito says, I don't know what caused the coup in Peru and would like to ask what started it and what are some of the events and factors that have led to the coup. Claudia, you're there in Peru. Yeah. Also, you know, why do you think the elites have moved against President Pedro Castillo at this time? Yeah, what do you reckon?
Well, I mean, they from the beginning, Fujimori did not recognize his win for about a month. I think that had been the longest that we had gone before. You know, the losing party actually conceded. From the very beginning, there were machinations against him. The corruption charges never really fully substantiated. Absolutely ridiculous in so many different ways. So they had it out for him in the beginning. One thing I had been mentioning to some comrades was the day that Hector Bejar had to step down for saying that perhaps the CIA had also been funding the Sendero Luminoso to turn their war against the left, he had to step down. And I do believe that it was after that. I was like, they're going to make this happen. This is going to happen.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember thinking that as well. And just for those who don't know, Hector Bejar was the foreign minister of Peru, picked by Pedro Castillo. And he was like this, he's like this old guy. And he was a Marxist professor in Lima. And he's the one that sort of led the normalization of relations with Venezuela and really created a foreign policy that's, you know, in line with the rest of the left-wing governments in Latin America. And then they got rid of him. The military basically pressured Pedro Castillo to get rid of him. And yeah, I agree with Claudia 100% that was a moment where I thought, there's a weakness here. And if they're not able to defend themselves from things like this, then...
Exactly.
You know, what's going on? And actually, Pedro Castillo's government, when he first takes office, was completely different to what it was by the end. Actually, when he first took office, he appointed as the prime minister a guy who was part of Peru Libre, who was a socialist, and his ministers were mostly socialists as well, like Hector Bejar. But then, within about a month, I think it was, all of that went out the window. They basically made an alliance with sort of a liberal party, sort of more liberal, more centrist party. And a lot of those ministers just were taken out. But Claudia, I wanted to go back to the issue of Lima and how people there in Lima sort of see what's going on. And there's some voice, it's definitely not majority, but some people within the South who are protesting against the coup, they're saying, you know, we're not represented by the central state in Lima, and they don't even recognize us as Peruvians. So maybe we shouldn't be part of. Some people are proposing us even a separation. It's definitely not a majority saying that or proposing that, but some people are. And a sense I always got when I was in Lima was that a lot of people just don't recognize indigenous Peruvians as citizens, as fellow Peruvians. Is that a sense that you get? How do the people in Lima understand what Peru is versus what it actually is?
Limeños think that Lima is the center of the world and that is the whole of Peru. that, I mean, this has been the case since, you know, we became a republic and the capital went from Cusco to Lima. And since then, power, all types of power, economic, you know, military, everything has been concentrated in Lima. If southern regions decide to split off, I was saying this earlier on Black Power Media, Lima will fall. We get most of our energy, everything from southern region, from the provincias, right? And so it's really wild to think, like, do you guys not understand that we literally live the life that we live off the backs of the people that are now being massacred, and you don't have anything to say, but you will take pictures with them in Cusco and you know, claim your indigenous side, but still call them savage indios.
Yeah, also water. Lima has zero water.
Yeah.
It never rains there ever. And the only water they get is from the mountains in the Andes. but yeah, I mean, Zoe, I don't know, when you were there, did you manage to speak to any people in Lima who were supportive of the coup and, you know, supportive of some of the repression that was going on? I mean, was this kind of the attitude that you'd see in every other kind of, in every Latin American country when these sorts of processes happen?
Well, I thankfully or not, I think because I was always like just managed to go to the kind of protests, I didn't actually speak to many maybe non-supporters. But seeing, as you all mentioned before, the covers of newspapers and magazines, it was really unlike anything I'd ever seen in my life. Of course, everywhere there's capitalism, there's media being dominated by corporate interests. But I think Peru really is a school in how to completely use this resource of, you know, newspapers, TV, radio, to completely delegitimize or attempt to delegitimize protests, to delegitimize anything that has to do with an anti-corporate narrative in any sort of way. And it was really horrifying to see this because, I mean, it's so extreme that it seems like almost no one has any faith in the media. And something that I encountered a lot is that going to any protests, taking out the camera, people just start to say, who are you? What are you doing? Are you from Lima? What newspaper are you from? I don't want to talk to you. You should get out of here. And it's completely legitimate. I mean, it makes total sense. People are constantly, anything they say is immediately manipulated. I went to Ayacucho for one day and I spoke to the leader of the Front for the Defense of the People of Ayacucho. And she was saying, and she's been, you know, accompanying a lot of the relatives of the victims of the massacre, really coordinating all of these efforts of continuing to demand justice, going out on the streets and protesting. And she was the victim of an extremely awful campaign by the media in Lima. She's been completely defamed, slandered on all of the mainstream media, calling her a terrorist, publishing her photo across all outlets. And it's dangerous. I mean, this is not just a question of saying that these protests are bad and they're causing economic damage, which is, of course, the baseline of what they're saying about the protests, without a doubt. But, you know, calling the protesters terrorists is giving essentially a blank sheet for the police to go out and assassinate these people. And it's they're working hand in hand with, you know, and they, a lot of people, again, at these protests would say, there's some, you know, all of these press and all of these journalists are receiving direct handouts from the government. And they were angry when Pedro Castillo was president because he didn't do this. And that's exactly what people are saying on the street. So I think this element is extremely important. And of course, if you're uncritically consuming any sort of media source in the country that has this narrative, then that's exactly what you're going to think. But I think so many people are now at the point where they're seeing just how biased it is and just how anti-people it is.
When I was in Desaguadero just yesterday at a protest, loads of people shouting at me, like, Prensa corrupta, get out. No, Bolivian. Like, oh, okay, it's fine. So, yeah, that was good then. But yeah, the issue of Bolivia has also come into this. And people saying this is orchestrated by Evo Morales. I'll tell you for a fact, Evo Morales has got enough on his plate without this. But they banned him and 9 other people, which is basically the people that went with him to Pedro Castillo's inauguration, including a colleague of mine, Cecia Vargas. But yeah, Claudia, how do people see Bolivia? And because I think this is, the government want to force this question, but it's something that actually does exist in terms of, you know, especially if you go to the South, people that have had interactions with Bolivia and where a lot of the, well, you know, the demands of people like a constituent assembly, like nationalization of natural resources has been implemented. So, yeah, how has Evo Morales and Bolivia seen there in Peru, both from, you know, ordinary people, but also from the media and the elites?
Yeah, well, so as usual, it's the Lima rest of Peru divide. So folks in the South, or really anywhere, but especially in the South, sometimes will go, literally jobs will be in Bolivia, across the border, that, you know, it's a, you know, we're sister nations. So there's all types of exchange, and people can actually see what a society that actually owns its own resources and the state, you know, has control over, that doesn't just, you know, sell to foreign nationals, foreign, you know, mining companies, for example, and sell it back to the people at, you know, 50% more. And because of this, a lot of the press, again, and Lima will say that it's Bolivians that are coming in, and not saying that actually it's our Peruvians from the South that are going to Bolivia to get, you know, for whatever necessities, right? Like to sell goods, whatever. So yeah, this is just like a, you know, continuation of the, you know, capital and the rest of Peru divide. It's very much a class divide. It's very much a racial divide. Yeah.
We got a question from Camila. Obviously, she's co-founder of Causation News. She was going to be on this stream. However, she sends her apology. Says, I was losing my voice with all the Brazil developments this week. But she also has a question. Says, is the coup regime fearful of the current general strike? Are they feeling the pressure? And is it foreseeable they could capitulate to any of the demands? And yeah, I don't know what... So how would you evaluate the strength of this government? A government, I think, to survive needs some sort of social base, even if it's not a majority. It needs some sort of ideological direction, or at least political direction, some sort of basis upon which the different groups within the government work together. Do we see that in Peru in the face of the massive mobilizations that are going on?
Well, I think that despite Dina Boluarte having been Pedro Castillo's vice president, having been from Peru Libre, she's quickly fallen into line with the far right and center in Peru. Her cabinet was approved, which includes many members, historic members of the, you know, repressive people who have participated in extreme crime. And so I think the fact that this cabinet was approved is sort of a vote of confidence. I don't think it's a real vote of confidence, but it's more kind of a realization of these sectors, political sectors, that they're going to have to line up behind her. I don't think she has any allegiance to any sort of project. I think right now she knows that she's going to be investigated for crimes against humanity, along with a host of other things. She really needs these political allies. So I don't see her breaking away at all from any of these sectors who just helped vote in this cabinet. But this definitely does give a little bit of a boost, because, of course, the parliamentary left is not strong enough to defeat this. And I mean, again, I think it's an unfortunate reality, but I think unless the United States were to maybe turn on her, she's not going to feel any real institutional pressure. I think that the strike has been extremely successful in continuing to put on pressure. And they're definitely feeling the impact of the widespread denunciations by international bodies, by human rights organizations within Peru, across the region of Latin America and the Caribbean, about this disproportionate use of violence, everything that her government has been doing. But I don't, it's just shocking that it still is continuing to exert this violence. So I'm wondering what you guys think about the strength of this government. I mean, Peru has a history of overthrowing governments, so it's not out of the question. But I think right now it seems like everyone's kind of falling in line to keep the ship afloat. But how long will it stay afloat? That's you know, unclear.
Yeah, Claudia, yeah. Same question, I guess, really. And like also the media and, you know, middle class sections in Lima, are they feeling scared? Are they, because I remember, for example, when there was the coup in Bolivia and the people were mobilizing, you know, you had this discourse from the middle class saying, oh, the Indians are going to come. They're going to come and destroy our edificios and all these sorts of things. Yeah. So, yeah. Are people feeling the heat in Lima? Are people worried? Especially because in a couple of days now, we're going to get marches to Lima from the southern regions as well.
Yeah, exactly. Right now, there is march happening in the center of Lima. I know that from the last couple of days ago that I went down there, some comrades from Ayacucho were saying that today they were going to bring a few delegations coming up. But exactly, more and more, it's going to be the same kind of rhetoric. The Indios are coming, and they're coming from the outer regions. But I don't know. I think it's interesting. I kind of tend to agree with Zoe that unless there's enough pressure and really coming from the, you know, global hegemon, that it's not, she's going to dig her heels in. It's going to continue. I mean, we are also digging our heels. It is an indefinite general strike. Yes, Lima is absolutely late to the game, and this is probably where most of the class contradictions happen. But regardless, even, you know, even in numbers, the working class and poor urban Peruvians are, you know, ready to take this golpista Congress down, and the coup regime in general.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess a related question to this is, I feel it's, you know, Peru is a different situation to when this happened in Bolivia, in that in Bolivia, the movements and were identified with one political organization, which is the movement towards socialism. But in Peru is a much more complicated. I think it's clear. I saw my own eyes. The movements on the ground are just as strong as in Bolivia or anywhere else. But in terms of political organization, is very complicated. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Zoe, when you were there, what political parties were present in this, or were they even part of this at all? Did people even want to see them, or like what were people saying about the main organizations like Peru Libre or others?
I think that in the regions, it seems like there's most of the mobilizations have had kind of an alliance of coordination. And Ayacucho, as I mentioned, the Front for the Defense of the People of Ayacucho was kind of central in articulating with a lot of different organizations, with peasant federations, with other local groups to kind of come together and call for a national strike, to call for the regional strike and call for mass mobilizations. And I think in different regions, this has different characters. Maybe it's the unions, local organizations, and I think that's really been kind of the force behind the strike in the south, is that organized areas where people are organized in peasant federations, in trade unions, have been really coming together, have been creating united plans for action and for struggle, and that's really been where they've getting their strength. And because they have the capacity to block the flow of goods, to block major highways, this makes a huge impact. On the first day I was there, or the second day I was there, was the raid on the headquarters of the Peasant Federation of Peru and on Nuevo Peru, which is a left political party. And that was a really powerful show of leftist forces in the city, in Lima. Of course, as you mentioned, there isn't necessarily one left political force that's really bringing together all of the people. There's many diverse demands. I think there's definitely division in terms of some people don't want elections. They actually just think that Pedro Castillo should come back and the measures that he proposed should be implemented, that there should be a constituent assembly immediately. So I think there's a lot of different visions about this. Peru Libre, of course, has a complex, is in a complex situation. Of course, it had its distances and challenges with Pedro Castillo. I think people are above all cognizant of the fact that the Peruvian left has been under attack for decades. And so there's a purpose behind repression. There's a purpose behind eliminating cadre from historic organizations. There's a purpose behind saying that anyone who's communist is a terrorist. And that obviously has had its effect in Peru, a place where the left really has been under attack, and that the internal armed conflict had a huge impact on the capacity of the left to mobilize, on the capacity of the left to come together, to have unity. There's a lot of open wounds still present in Peru. And I think that really marks the possibility of what can happen. A lot of these open wounds have to do with, of course, the structure of the state, what political participation looks like, but also, you know, what was the impact of this internal armed conflict on the left? I think these are questions that haven't been really able to be addressed because there's just been continued attack and a continued assault on people's rights, on people's livelihoods. Survival in Peru is extremely difficult. It's one of the most unequal countries in Latin America and the Caribbean. It had the second highest death toll from COVID. These are fundamental questions that really affect the ability of organizations to flourish and to organize. So I think these are all at play. And of course, the coup against Pedro Castillo maybe wouldn't have been possible if there had been a more united left, if there had been capacity to come together around his candidacy. But these are the contradictions that we're faced with, historical contradictions. I think there's going to be a new moment for the left in the coming period in Peru. It's going to rebuild itself. There's going to be probably a new moment of coming together and trying to deal with these divisions and have a moment of self-criticism as the left always must have as it's moving forward in history. And so, of course, I think the different institutional left organizations, ones that have representation in the Congress, have had a very challenging moment. I think people are upset with them because they didn't do more maybe to stop the coup and to stop the subsequent measures. But of course, it's a very adverse situation that people are dealing with.
Yeah. And definitely. And before I come to you, Claudia, with the same questions, going to read out a couple of comments. Mario Vargas says, make those limeños sweat pilas, because that's a saying in Spanish, to make them sweat. Big Teal says, fascists will take what they want, if not stop, but agree that without a base and direction, that task becomes difficult. And Camila says, I'm not Peruvian or Bolivian, but my own personal view is that is a dangerous precedent for Evo to not have carried out his fourth mandate. Equally, Pedro Castillo should resume the presidency. So this is part of my question to Claudia, is that obviously the demand is clear now from protests that people want immediate elections. But do you think, like, is it also a legitimate demand to say that Pedro Castillo should finish his term, which is until 2025? Or could we say that Pedro Castillo could be a candidate in possible elections? I think a big reason why they've arrested Pedro Castillo is, and why they have to keep him in jail now, is, however, you know, whatever people thought of him before the coup and whatever disappointments people might have had before the coup, I think if he comes out now, do you think he would just win the elections?
I do. But I think when I talk to folks here, organizations that have been working, so I came to Lima the day before the general strike started, the January 3rd. And so I've just been here, but organizations that have been on the ground much longer have been saying that the new election should just be for Congress and that Pedro Castillo should actually finish out his term because the masses overwhelmingly voted for him, especially in the outer, like I said, in the, you know, outer regions, in Lima, of course, you know, typical. But yeah, so it, and if it becomes just a general election, then I do think he would also resoundingly win.
And following on from that, like, you know, some of what Zoe is talking about the political articulation of the protest, because we can see, I mean, in the comment, Big T was talking about the, you know, yeah, base and direction. There's clearly a base for the left. The direction, where is that coming from, or who can it come from? What political parties are available or on the scene right now, there, Claudia?
Yeah, so there's a few more like cultural associations. One of the folks that I've been seeing out there a lot are Agora Popular, and they've really been doing a lot of political education in the plaza. Talk very much connecting the issue of neoliberalism and you know, as we mentioned before, we were the second largest death toll from COVID. Those are the, you know, effects of this like brutal neoliberal system that, you know, we did, so many people couldn't afford just a tank of oxygen, or it was being held, you know, literally the vaccines had been held hostage for months in within the rich areas of Lima. So these are some of the things that, you know, people have been coming out in the street for and to tile these things. People, you know, talk about the, you know, 13 U.S. military bases here, the U.S. ambassador that met with Boluarte beforehand, or with the one of the ministers beforehand. You know, I do believe the political consciousness is there. I have, you know, coming from New York, I was thinking, I wasn't sure what necessarily the political organization would be here, but I guess in some ways I'm pleased. I do think that the leadership is going to be coming from when the people from the South start coming up here.
Yeah, and so yesterday, people were, well, at least in Desaguadero, saying that in 48 hours we're going to go to Lima, obviously, if the demands aren't met. Well, thank you so much, both of you, Zoe and Claudia, for joining us today. We're going to wrap this up. I'm going to put the Twitter handles for both Zoe and Claudia in this chat right now. Zoe, co-editor of People's Dispatch. Last saw you here in Bolivia when there was the elections here, and you were an observer. So it's good that you were able to make it to Peru as well. And Claudia from the Black Alliance for Peace on the Haiti Americas team. I'm just putting, so both their handles are in the chat right now. Thank you to everyone who's taken part. I think we've had some viewers from Black Power Media, so a lot of people have been commenting to that effect in the chat. So thank you to everyone taking part. Thank you to Claudia, Zoe. We're going to be back next week with you know, we have two shows per week, and I think we're almost certainly going to be having an episode on Peru again. So thank you to everyone. Zoe, we've put your Twitter in the chat. Anything else you would like to plug here as we close out?
You can find all of our coverage at peoplesdispatch.org. We cover movements, people's movements from across the world, from Peru to India to South Africa. So do check us out. Follow us on social media at People's Dispatch. And thanks so much for having me and inviting me. It's great to always be with comrades and people in the trenches of the communications battle.
Cheers, Zoe. Claudia, anything you want to plug before we end this?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. And it was really great talking to everyone. You can follow our work at Black Alliance for Peace and on all of the social medias. We have a website. Hopefully soon we'll be coming out with a statement around Peru and then tying in broader, larger lawfare attacks in the region. So that's where you can find our work.
Excellent. And both of their Twitter handles are in the chat. And this will close out. And we'll see you next week for more discussion and analysis of Latin America. Thank you very much, everyone.